Right, paper 12A, Toshi. No, sorry, we finished that.
Agenda paper 12. Agenda paper 12 deals with a request for guidance on how an entity should resume presenting financial statement in accordance with IFRS after a period when it could not comply with IAS 29 because the entity's functional currency suffered from chronic hyperinflation. In May 2010, the committee concluded that IAS 29 should be amended and asked the staff to give further analysis and propose draft wording for the amendment. Staff have prepared three papers from 12A to 12C. 12A is cover note, and 12B deals with the key issue that was part of the request relating to the accounting for an entity which ceases to have a functional currency that is the currency of chronic hyperinflationary economy. And agenda paper 12C deals with the issue relating the consolidated financial statement of an entity which has an interest in an entity that has a functional currency that suffers from chronic hyperinflation. Please turn to agenda paper 12B and the summary of the proposed amendment discussed in the May committee meeting is provided in paragraph 11 to paragraph 25. At the meeting, the staff proposed a new accounting entity notion and that the entity which emerged from chronic hyperinflation should be considered a new accounting entity because a new accounting entity has no historical accounting information. That entity is not required to present comparative information. And a general principle would then be applied that assets and liabilities of the entity should be measured at fair value at that date when the entity emerges from chronic hyperinflation. And the staff provides the key elements of this proposed amendment from paragraph 26. The explanation of definition of chronic hyperinflation and a new accounting entity notion is begins in paragraph 26 and 32. And next, details of presentation of opening statement, financial statement, begin in paragraph 37. As mentioned earlier, the basic principle is that the assets and liabilities of the entity should be measured at fair value. There are some exceptions to fair value measurement. Most of the exceptions are consistent with IFRS 3 business combinations. And next, a discussion about prospective application begins in paragraph 48. And next, which standards should be amended? Discussion is begins in paragraph 57. The staff believes that the IAS 29 should be amended because this application of the amendment, the application of the amendment, only applies to specific situation relating to IAS 29. The staff believes this approach is the most appropriate for the consolidated financial statement as discussed in agenda paper 12C. And disclosure starts in paragraph 70. And finally, appendix D provides the timeline illustrated examples relating to application of the proposed amendment. And please move on to the agenda paper 12C. As discussed, as mentioned, 12C deals with the consolidated financial statement. The staff provides four situations as examples of the application of this amendment in paper 12B to consolidated financial statement, and with an illustrated timeline example in Appendix A. The staff specifically highlights the issue raised in situation 3 for consideration by the committee. The staff believe when a parent regains control and subsequently reconsolidates the interest because of the chronic hyperinflation issue, that the resulting consolidation adjustments should be recognized in equity, not profit or loss. The staff believe that the proposed amendment works for the consolidated financial statement as well as separate financial statements. Please move back to Agenda Paper 12B. Based on agenda criteria assessment, which begins in paragraph 82, and annual improvement criteria assessment, the staff recommends the committee should not add this issue to its agenda, and the staff proposed that committee recommends the board make a separate amendment to IS 29. The staff provides a draft wording for the tentative agenda decision and amendments to IS 29 and consequential amendments in Appendix A and Appendix B and C. Does the committee agree with this staff recommendation?
And maybe, Bob, I'll just add one thing before we get the committee's thoughts on this. Just for purposes of the committee, we have obviously been engaging a lot, particularly with the South African and Zimbabwean standard setters and their representatives on this issue throughout. And we've had calls with them in the last week or so since finalising our papers. And although they have some drafting questions and some things they would like to see clarified in final wording, certainly we've heard very positive feedback from them on the approach here. And certainly the sense we got from them was that, this is something that could be practically applied both at the subsidiary level and also at the parent level. I say they did have some drafting comments and some detailed points around here. But broadly, we've received, I'd say, positive feedback on the proposals here.
Thank you, David. All right, open it to members to comment. Patrick or Julie? Julie?
Usually, as the observer, I let you talk first. But on this one, I think we have some experience as regulators in dealing with these situations that I thought might be helpful to give you before you get too far into it, as opposed to letting you talk and then bringing it up at the end. So I'm not trying to overplay my role here as an observer. So maybe two points. One is, it seems like I wasn't sure where the notion of the reporting entity comes into play here, because the thing that reports, we call the reporting entity, and that's kind of the legal entity or that's the issuer, however you want to call it. And it indeed has historical information about its operations and its financial affairs, even when it was in this period of chronic hyperinflation. And so if I'm the regulator and I'm looking at an issuer who's presenting information to the capital markets, the reporting entity, the legal entity, has been there through this whole period of time. And so I don't just say, well, because its basis of accounting is potentially switched, which is what is proposed at a certain point in time, therefore that wipes away the reporting entity, and therefore I should portray as if this legal entity didn't exist and it didn't do anything and, wasn't information to report. We actually take the opposite tack of what's discussed here, which is the reporting entity was there, things went on, the information is maybe kind of unique to how we're actually going to present it, what went on in this period of chronic hyperinflation. But indeed, it isn't misleading to present some information. It's misleading to omit, you know, all prior period information. And so, for example, we faced this when Russia had what you might call chronic hyperinflation in the early 90s.
Sorry. We have defined chronic hyperinflation.
Okay.
Russia did not have that.
Okay. Well, in any event, all using that as an analogy, we faced a situation where it was difficult to figure out what to do with the prior year, but the conclusion wasn't, do nothing, because indeed the reporting entity existed. So we've thought of these issues as the reporting entity existed, the question is what's the basis of accounting, versus this notion of an accounting entity trumping the notion that the entity existed. So to me, there were two questions here. What's the basis of accounting when you emerge from this period? And that, you know, is debated. And a second question, different question, is, well, how do you report when the basis of accounting was something else? But all I'm saying is, in experience as regulators, when the basis of accounting was something else, that doesn't mean don't report anything. It's certainly through display and disclosure, you have to be very careful about making sure investors know that the basis of accounting switched. But just because there is a different basis of accounting doesn't mean you don't provide the information.
Okay. Do you happen to know, Julie, if the analogous situation you were talking about in Russia, whether or not financial statements of earlier periods when it was suffering from hyperinflation were in fact audited?
I don't know about audited, other than, I don't know, point of fact, like I've looked at a filing, but I do know the SEC, using our own personal experience, the SEC won't accept financial statements that aren't audited, and we actually had financial statements for those prior periods. I mean, they worked out a convention for how to present them, but I don't know, like I've looked at a filing, so that's negative assurance on that regard, in that regard.
I don't know if these circumstances are similar or completely different, then it's difficult to tell. My understanding is for most of these companies that they have heavily qualified audit opinions on the prior financial statements because there are just so many uncertainties. Currency that is not exchangeable with any other recognized currency, so there's no basis of transfer. Most of the transactions that took place were barter transactions of goods and services rather than currency units, and the lack of what IS-29 wants, which is a reliable.
But I guess I was thinking it more broadly, too, because we run into new basis, which in essence is what we're proposing here, do a new basis. We have new basis issues outside of hyperinflation or chronic hyperinflation. I mean, emerging from bankruptcy, a variety of other situations. So this is one version of a new basis question, which comes up frequently. And every time a new basis question comes up, we don't omit prior period information because the reporting entity was there. So that's the macro approach to new basis, is it's important to distinguish a new basis, but it doesn't automatically translate into omitting.
Julie, could I just ask where you've got the comparators presented, but you've got this change of basis, new basis. The comparators presented, are they presented in accordance with an authoritative GAAP? So in accordance with US GAAP or whatever.
Yeah. And it just very pragmatically, mechanically, which is no magic, perfect solution. In our country, we have a double black line between the columns of the current year, which is one basis, and the prior year, which is the other basis. And that double black line is not only a face of financial statements, it goes all the way through every schedule, everything. I mean, there's nothing fancy about the double black line, but the point of the story is to try to somehow make it clear that the basis has changed through more than just words, but that a change in basis doesn't trump the fact reporting entity was there and stuff like that.
Because one of the challenges we have here is for a period of time, compliance with IFRS was not possible.
I think just to expand on this accounting entity, reporting entity thing, I did think this through. How would an SEC registrant deal with this? And the black line, I think, is right. Now, it so happens that a company in this situation likely would not be able to meet SEC requirements because the SEC would require the stuff on the other side of the black line to be there. That stuff would have to be audited. I think the accounting entity that existed before the company comes out of chronic hyperinflation would be, in SEC terms, probably considered a predecessor, and the SEC requires predecessor
financial statements when a predecessor exists, and so a Zimbabwean company registered with the SEC, which I'm guessing there are zero, might be able to take advantage of this to get a clean opinion on its IFRS financial statements on one side of the black line, that is the later time period after it came out of chronic hyperinflation, wouldn't help them with the period before the black line with SEC requirements. I think they couldn't prepare those financial statements that would be required for the SEC. We can't get around the fact that the SEC requires predecessor financial statements, but by saying we have a new accounting entity, I think it allows them to get a clean IFRS opinion on the post-hyperinflation statements. Does that make sense to you, Julie?
Yeah, obviously I'm drawing on our experience as a U.S. regulator, but I wasn't trying to portray that out. I was just saying, as a regulator, you're looking at this entity existed legally, and that's the issuer of securities. And so the fact that it existed means then you're sort of compelled to, well, what information do we have? What can we make available? And the paper seemed to be taking the tack, and maybe I overread it, that there was sort of a trigger that once you had new basis, ergo, you wipe away whatever the reporting entity had because it's not comparable. And all I'm saying is in our regulatory experience, that hasn't prevailed, that the lack of comparability has been dealt with through display and disclosure, but the balance has been that providing what you can is better than not providing anything.
Right.
That's the way sort of a regulator has looked at it. So I had some, needless to say, consternation of the philosophy that a change in basis would, question one, would also lead to an automatic answer in question two to take away the prior stuff.
Right, yeah, and I thought of it exactly the same as if you had to apply pushdown. You have a new accounting entity under GAAP, you'd probably get a clean opinion on simply the post-pushdown, new basis, fresh start, whatever you want to call them, financial statements. That wouldn't suffice, though, for at least an SEC filing, because the SEC would require information about the predecessor accounting entity as well. And were I the SEC looking at those rules, I think I'd be saying, well, that's nice. You can now get a clean opinion for the period post-hyperinflation, but that still doesn't allow you to meet the reporting requirements because you've got to have the predecessor stuff as well. I don't think we can solve that problem.
One thing we can probably focus on, though, and it's helpful to have the comments, Julie. We respect the fact you're an observer and you give us helpful hints, not orders.
That's all right.
But this wasn't an intention that this is how new basis accounting should be applied generally in IFRS. This is specifically to coming out of chronic hyperinflation in the circumstances where financial reporting could not have existed within IFRS in a previous period, which our investigation has, that's been borne out by the fact that the audit opinions have all been qualified or disclaimed heavily. So there is no way in which companies have been able to report in compliance. All right. Anyway, with that helpful background, Joanna?
In terms of the IAS 29 amendment, and subject to what Julia said, I mean, I thought it was an excellent paper, your 2B paper, and I basically agreed with all your conclusions around the Zimbabwean, so the actual hyperinflation entity. And I do wonder, though, whether, having now heard Julie, whether we actually need to say a new accounting entity or whether we can say a new accounting basis, but you don't have to do any comparatives if you don't have the information. And I don't know, but whether we can get around that. But to me, I was very, very comfortable. However, I do have a concern in relation to your paper 2C. Now, our tentative decision does not discuss, if you like, the consolidated entity, and therefore, arguably, I was happy with our decision on the basis that we are not considering the consolidated entity. I am not convinced at all by a number of your arguments in 2C that it is actually workable without some consequential amendments to IFRS 1, and in particular...
Can I stop you there, because if we're on a roll with 2B, can we just see if others have comments on that, and then I'll come back on a separate paper.
It's just Toshi brought them together. I was going to deal with them separately and say, yep, happy with 2B, but he was the one that brought them together.
Toshi
so
is keen to get out for some morning coffee.
Okay.
So be patient, Toshi. Laurence.
I definitely support the approach in the agenda paper 2B, but I have questions about what do the approach mean in some certain circumstances. My first concern relates to intangible assets. I understand that no goodwill will be recognized, but I understand that you require recognition of intangible assets. Do you mean all identifiable intangible assets, including internally generated intangible assets? And you do refer to ISSA to say you recognize those intangible assets that meet the recognition criteria in ISSA. And when I look at the recognition criteria in ISSA, paragraph 21, and in particular B, it says an intangible asset shall be recognized if and only if the cost of the asset can be measured reliably. So what does it mean in this context, determining the cost reliably? So I would like to have further clarification about what type of intangible assets would be recognized in this new basis of accounting, and how do you make it tie with the recognition criteria of ISSA. Second concern relates to IFRS 2. IFRS 2, is it the intent that you measure the share-based payment awards as if they had been granted on the date you switched to the new measurement basis? If so, you need to clarify this. Third, leases. How do you assess leases for classification between finance lease, operating lease? Do you do it with consideration of the criteria at the date you change basis of accounting, or do you go back to the original assessment? Perhaps we need also some guidance on contract revenue, IF 11 for unbundling, possibly that you do it maybe not at inception of the contract, but at the date when you switch the accounting basis. Similar comment for application of government grants for measurement or assessment at the date of switching.
We're getting into the realms of the hypothetical now. Government grants in this country actually worked the other way. The government the government stole from the people, didn't give them anything.
You also indicate some. You also indicate some exemptions to a fair value measurement because you have the standards IS 12, IS 19, and so on. To that list, I would add IS 37 and IFRS 4, because IS 37, the measurement basis is not fair value measurement, and IFRS 4 either. And finally, you indicate that you would not provide some guidance on the measurement of non-controlling interests. The staff do not believe on the basis of the scope and key objective of the amendment that specific guidance on other components of equity should be provided. I do believe that perhaps you need to clarify that you want to have non-controlling interest measured, recognized and measured at fair value if this is the new basis for accounting. I do believe you need to spell it out.
When you say fair value, do you mean fair value or do you mean at the proportional interest in the entity?
That's to be discussed.
Well, no, I'm asking you the questions now. You've raised a lot of questions. Can you tell me what you would prefer for each of those so that the staff has some idea of what you would like? For example, on intangibles, what intangibles do you think they should recognize?
I think it would be fair to recognize all intangible assets that are identifiable because on one hand, we are eliminating any goodwill that has been recognized. So on the other hand, it makes sense that if we do a kind of fresh start, we identify all items, all assets and liabilities,
and you recognize them at fair value.
So customer relationship intangibles, they should go searching for those.
But that's the logic, huh? If we say recognize...
You're so empathetic. David? Sorry, the other one that I was interested in, leases. You had a concern about leases. Was it just lease classification, or did you want to measure leases at fair value?
Lease classification and whether or not you should recognize favorable and unfavorable lease contracts, this type of thing.
Well, that's why I was asking, what is it in the lease contract you want to recognize?
The logic, if the new basis of accounting is fair value, if we want to be consistent with this new basis of accounting, then you would have to recognize the effect of favorable or unfavorable leases.
I understand the words. I'm just trying to understand how you think people can do that.
But the contracts, what do the contracts say compared to marketplaces? I suppose they are still contracts, are they?
Well, except just to remind you that we're not talking about a business combination where there are similar transactions and market prices that exist. A lot of the market prices that exist in here, because there wasn't a stable currency, could have been expressed in foreign currencies. Some other stable currency, but not necessarily the functional currency that is going to be used going forward, or could be on the basis of barter-type transactions. So when you glibly say market prices, I think operationally that's difficult to determine. It's one thing to get a hypothetical market participant, but to create a hypothetical market participant in a hypothetical market.
Well, my point is perhaps these areas need a little bit research.
All right, you raised a lot of issues anyway. So have you got a note of those, David?
Yeah, no, I will add it's a similar list to some of the feedback we had from the South African and Zimbabwean constituents from reviewing the paper. And, there's a couple of sort of broad things when you work through these issues. One is, to what extent are we looking at IFRS 3 and you're using that as your start point, or to what extent are you saying, this is kind of not quite an IFRS 3 situation, and maybe from a practical standpoint, some of the IFRS 3 places aren't the right place to be. I think generally the feedback we've had from this constituent group is, they like a model based on a sort of IFRS 3 thought process, but because of the practical application issues, their preference would probably be to, I use the word limit the intangibles you're recognizing, just from a practical, they're hunting through everything and customer list intangibles. From a practical application sense, they were less interested, less keen in going down that path. Having said that, I think there are some here where we can provide a bit of extra guidance. I'm going to counter that as well with, I think, the same point. Some of this gets into some quite detailed application guidance, and it's already quite a lengthy amendment. So I think we've got to strike the balance here between to what extent people use their judgment in applying the other IFRSs, to what point we want to require application of IFRS 3 here, and then at what point is it just down to people to work through their judgment and application.
Thanks, David. Ruth?
I had the same issue as Julie before you raised it. So my issue was that we're saying this is a new accounting entity, and I immediately thought, well, there must be a number of other circumstances where an entity would like to say, I've made significant errors in the past, or I've come out of administration or something, so I'd like to be treated as a new accounting entity. My preference would be, and acknowledging that this is a very specific circumstance that we're trying to find a solution to, and I don't think we should spend years trying to find a solution to it. I think we need to be pragmatic as much as we can. If we said it's not a new accounting entity, but it is a new basis, and then give exemption for comparatives, we do it in 29 or however we need to do it, That then allows you to look back to the contracts that were in existence, and you wouldn't have to ignore them because you could say they were there. So you don't have to re-fair value everything or start with everything again as if they were never there. At least allows you to look at what is there, and 29 can be specific and say, you know, contracts that are in existence, you can use a previous date, or you can be as pragmatic as you like to be, as you need to be, effectively. And then you can require fair value for everything else. I just think that might give us a more practical solution if we say it's a basis, a new basis rather than a new entity, and then we deal with the comparative issue by virtue of an exemption, because I can't see any other way out of the comparatives problem. So that would be my suggestion. And that we make it really narrow to the circumstance, and that would then avoid my problem with all sorts of other circumstances or entities saying, hey, I want to be a new accounting entity now that my past was a mistake or irrelevant or whatever. I don't like what my past looked like, so can you make it go away, please? So I would prefer a new basis and keep the entity.
Right, so the same outcome, but
same outcome.
Wording differently.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Jean-Louis?
I think I have comments that are close to that. I mean, first thing, I think it's difficult for IFRIC to go into such a detailed application implementation guidance. So, and I was also asking myself a question about the concept of new entity. So, in my view, it's more a new situation, and I would try, probably, we had this discussion previously, to enter in the possibility of application of IFRS 1 more than once, and then by exception treat some specific issues. Because if we don't go this way, we have a list of... we are trying to rewrite IFRS 1, and I think that we should... it would be more convenient and a better support on a theoretical point of view to start from IFRS 1 and then adapt for a specific situation. Because apart from that, we are covering different issue, but lack of conceptual support, for example, in the paragraph 42 of the paper, or why should we make reference to IFRS 3 because there is no opposition. So if it makes me... in a difficult situation, and I would follow the way saying that's new, not a new entity, new situation, adapt what is in IFRS 1 because it's using the concept you can apply IFRS 1 more than once and then make some exception or additions. For example, you cannot fair value at deemed cost, use fair value at deemed cost for intangible asset. That's a difficulty, so we should try to find solution by exception to our first one, in my view.
Andrew?
I did have a few queries around intangibles, but that's now been dealt with, but I was happy with the general direction of this. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't need to consider any consequential changes to the definition of functional currency in IAS 21, because as the paper points out at paragraph 28, the definition of functional currency, and both these characteristics exist, i.e. the one about the price index and exchangeability, although the definition of functional currency in paragraph 8 of IAS 21 is met, the staff believe the currency is no longer functional. So do we not need to... I mean, this says that the whatever currency it was is still the functional currency. And if it was the functional currency, then shouldn't it prepare accounts in accordance with that functional currency? We seem to be agreeing that's not the right answer. So I just wonder whether you need some exception to the definition of functional currency within IAS 21 as a byproduct of what we're doing.
Or alternatively, just thinking on the fly from what Ruth was saying, that if we give an exemption to presenting comparative information, but also make it clear that it's from the date on which the new functional currency, the date on which they emerge from chronic hyperinflation, in effect, that is the date from which they start reporting, and then exempt the comparatives. We don't actually have to change the definition of a functional currency because they won't be presenting information for that earlier period. Can we look at that in the drafting, Andrew? That's a good point. Anything else? Guido?
Well, first, short comment on the discussion that has been made before on whether we should everything value at fair value and whether we should recognize intangibles that you would not recognize if you would be an ongoing entity. I tend to take the other view. I don't think it makes sense that you have a full fair value financial statement that would also include goodwill, obviously, because if you would fair value every asset and every liability, it would not make sense to take out goodwill. So I don't think that that's the right answer. I'm more on the side to say, look at the IFRS statements. What can you recognize in accordance with these statements? Generally use fair value, but there are exceptions. For instance, as just mentioned, IFRS 2, I would also tend to say that for leases, we should look at whether it makes sense to have a fair value measurement for those. So I would go in this direction and not say fair value everything and recognize all assets, even if you would not be allowed to recognize them under 38 or 16 or whatever.
I didn't quite understand the point you're making about goodwill. Do you say that you wouldn't recognize goodwill, or that you think we should calculate and recognize goodwill?
I think we should not, but I think,
okay.
But I think that if you would fair value everything, we also would need to recognize goodwill, which I think is not a good answer. That's one argument against the fair value measurement.
Okay.
Second point also relates to 21, but has another point. I think 21 in paragraph 35 to 37 gives some guidance on when you change your functional currency, and that is one of the situations that we might face here. The chronic hyperinflation currency might cease to be chronic hyperinflation, but you could also change your functional currency, for instance, to US dollars. And we need to make clear that the guidance in 21, when you change a functional currency, does not apply in this situation, but 29 applies, and I think that's not so clear in the proposed wording yet.
So that would be a consequential amendment to 21 then?
Either 21 or...
Changes in functional currency in the circumstances described in 29.
Yes. Then you go to IAS 29 and not to 21.
Okay. Just then to go back, you said give an exemption additionally for leases not to be reflected at fair value. So how would you propose that leases, to the extent that there are leases, would be recognized?
Well, if you would stick to the rule that I've proposed, you would look at the classification at the date when chronic hyperinflation ceases to be in this country, or you have a new functional currency, which might be in the middle of the year, might be any date.
Yeah.
You would then classify in accordance with IAS 17, whether it's operating or finance lease. If operating don't recognize anything, it's finance lease. I would simply calculate if I'm the lessee, the lease liability, and then recognize at the same amount the lease asset. I would not fair value the lease, the liability would not include own credit debt, for instance.
Right. The classification at date to come out of hyperinflation would be consistent with the staff view, would it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's in the paper.
But the difference you have from Laurence is that you wouldn't try and think about off-market.
Right. Right.
You would just... recognize it as if it had started from there.
Yes.
And my view, I generally lean, call it a more practical view on some of these as far as we can versus, I sound more in the sort of exceptions to IFRS 3 than taking the literal IFRS 3, recognizing everything.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that. Scott?
I thought the proposal was very good. I would do some things differently, although if they get done as drafted, I certainly wouldn't object to the proposal. But I would actually have just started with IFRS 3. And just said, new basis of accounting, apply IFRS 3 as if the purchase price was the fair value at the date that you cease to be chronic hyperinflationary. That would be the proposal. Constituents come back with us and tell us which parts of IFRS 3 might be difficult or impossible for you to apply. The reason I like that is because we have answers to all these measurement questions under IFRS 3. We know which exceptions apply. We know what we would do with lease classification. We know the answers to those questions, so we have a model. Otherwise, we're making a model, and we'll miss something, I think. So I prefer to start with IFRS 3. I think you could also start with IFRS 1, as Jean-Louis suggested, but I think for in the concept of new accounting entity, new accounting basis, IFRS 3 feels better to me. But my main recommendation is start with a model that exists, and let's ask the constituents if they can't do that, and if not, we can start making some changes. Rather than, I think if we build from the ground up, I'm afraid we'll miss something, and it won't come out until it's too late. And I didn't have as long a list as Laurence did of the other questions we'd have to answer, so thank you for amplifying that. But that was the gist of my concern. The other thing that I wanted to ask about, we've defined this thing as chronic hyperinflation. I thought there was risk in using those words. When Julie spoke earlier, she said, you know, we had chronic hyperinflation in Russia. Bob, you pointed out that not according to this definition, but I'm a little bit concerned. I mean, that, yeah, there are some things that I think routinely people would say are chronic hyperinflation that wouldn't meet this definition. I wonder if we can pick different words. Andrew hinted at, you know, maybe the situation is you don't have a functional currency because of this. I don't know what other implications that would have, but I thought we might find a term other than chronic hyperinflation simply to avoid the potential of people applying this in situations where we didn't think it applied.
I think we'd be on dangerous ground if we said absolutely it doesn't have a functional currency when some people think IAS 21
right.
actually says it still does. So that would give us a different type of problem. But Scott, you know the rule in here that if you want to change a name, you have to come up with a suggestion.
I would call it Jim. I think I like that name. And I'm not going to have any more kids, so I will never get to name one Jim. So we could name this. As I recall, at one point, the financial statement presentation project was called George because the board forbade anybody to solve problems in other projects by referring to financial statement presentations. So
we're using male forenames because that project hasn't yet seen the light of day.
I understand. So I will think about words and propose them.
All right. I don't think we were tied down that chronic hyperinflation is actually something that is important. And I know we've used terms before like dysfunctional economies. But so, all right, thinking caps on and see if we can come up with a title for that. So in essence, David, I'm going to have to ask you to respond if you consider this issue and discuss it with them, that if we were to say, rather than giving the long list, I think a lot of the exceptions you've given to fair value are based on the IFRS 3 type exceptions. So it looks if that's the type of approach that we're following, if you want to call it a principled approach, would they have, do you think, some difficulty if we were to say that you do the accounting as if it was a newly acquired entity under IFRS 3, use the recognition and measurement guidance in IFRS 3, that does raise the specter of recognizing some intangibles that otherwise wouldn't have been recognized. So you might have to consider giving a separate exemption in some way for that.
Yes, and I think I just add in with the exception of goodwill to not recognizing the.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
I certainly think if we. The approach is written as you're starting with IFRS 3, I'd maybe, rather than just asking the constituents to come back to us with the exceptions they propose, I think there are a couple here that we've brought out in the paper discussed today that I would probably propose including in the draft. We can see if any more come back. But I'm comfortable with that approach. I have to think it through a little bit more. My sense would be you get to a similar place to at least where we're starting from here, but I do agree that the catch-all approach, I think, probably is a better starting point here.
So. Peter?
So please keep in mind when we are going down this route, I think it's not practical to do it. People are having problems already applying IFRS 3, the purchase price allocation for intangibles. Now, we are in a situation here where a company just gets out of chronic hyperinflation or out of gym. And we are asking them to measure intangible assets, the customer relationships. It's impossible. It's a nice theory, but I think we should keep that in mind, the situation that these companies are in. I agree it would be easy to apply IFRS 3, but I think we need to have a lot of exceptions from IFRS 3, keeping in mind the situation that the company is in. So maybe at the end of the day, we really then end up again with this list here, all the exceptions, but I just want to make sure that we keep in mind the situation that the companies are in.
Laurence had made a suggestion earlier, which is going to bring us back to anyway in a moment, which was IAS 38 talks about the recognition being different because you'd have to be able to identify the costs of acquiring those items. So if it was a previously purchased intangible, you'd be averse to including that at fair value as opposed to internally generated, which would not have been recognized because you wouldn't have met the IAS 38 conditions before. Would that be a solution to your concern?
No, I would recognize intangibles that have been acquired. As I said, my solution would be look at the standards, everything that would be recognized under the standards, recognize it, but then measure it at fair value with some exceptions that we have talked about, share-based payments, employee benefits, and so on and so on.
All right, because that would then have to be a specific exception, I think, because that would be different from IFRS 3. So you'd need to think carefully about the words in there. Okay. Laurence?
Hearing committee members' comments, I think I tend to believe that starting with IFRS 1 as a basis and to reconsider those cases where we would want to have assets or liabilities measured at fair value is probably an easier way than going from an IFRS 3 starting point. And the initial comment I had made was in light of what was proposed in paragraph 38G of...
Sorry, can I just ask you a question? IFRS 1 really starts on the basis that you would use the amounts that you would have otherwise recognized had you always been applying IFRS,
yeah,
and then giving exceptions for simplification to allow fair value in certain circumstances.
Yeah.
Here we were starting with a basis saying use fair value for everything except in certain circumstances like income taxes where you measure them differently. Why would you want to start having people think, how can I construct the cost of my PP&E?
Because IFRS 1 is a standard that has been, where time has been spent looking at more comprehensively to all the issues on, you know, applying a new basis of accounting, which is IFRS. And so
there's,
I believe,
not a new basis of accounting.
Here, we're going for a new basis of accounting somehow. In some cases, we will require certain liabilities to be measured at fair value. In some of the cases, it's not going to be fair value exactly. So... this is why I do have that concern about that paragraph 38G of the proposed amendment to IS 29 in Appendix B, where it says assets and liabilities recognized by the new accounting entity in the opening IFRS statement financial position shall be measured at fair value. So to have this broad principle at fair value, after hearing committee members' comments, I'm starting to question whether this should be the base. And perhaps to do it the other way around.
Okay, just remind committee members that the proposal that came to us from this particular country and jurisdiction was that they used fair value because they felt that was the only way they could start. When we talk about new basis accounting, I think IFRS 3 establishes the new basis. IFRS 1 gives Christmas gifts to people to allow them a simpler way of arriving at a number that approximates or is acceptable as a surrogate for what its accumulated cost would have been otherwise. So it's corner.
Just one thought, looking out for the regulators again on disclosure. I can understand it saying, and you don't, you know, new basis, and you don't, the model is new basis, and you don't have to have any comparative IFRS financial statements. But I'd like to suggest that it have that tagline, IFRS financial statements, as opposed to just say, you don't need anything comparative. I mean, because as a regulator, we may cobble together in a very thoughtful way, you know, some form of information for the prior periods that we think is necessary that stops short of IFRS financial statements. And I just wouldn't want this to imply that they get a blanket exemption, that they don't need to provide any financial data whatsoever.
Right.
I can appreciate this committee can't decide anything less than what would be a set of IFRS statements, but that doesn't mean a regulator in a practical registrant situation couldn't suggest that you got to have certain information to not be misleading. And I don't want the interpretation to imply that the regulator, you know, can't be creative in the situation. So.
Okay. No, it's a fair point, I think. We don't prohibit people from including five-year comparatives that are not IFRS compliant either. So,
yeah.
Right. Final comment, Ruth?
Just to say I support going down the IFRS 3 path rather than IFRS 1 because IFRS 1 assumes that you had recorded some numbers under a previous method and that they were considered to be reliable under that previous gap. So it's a very different platform to go from. Whereas IFRS 3 assumes you're starting again. And this is a starting again. Whether I'm not sure whether we've agreed it's a new accounting entity or a new accounting basis, but either way, it's starting again. So I would rather go start IFRS 3 and make some exceptions to it rather than IFRS 1.
All right. In view of the time and the need for a coffee break, or at least a comfort break, and we still have to come back to Joanna's concerns, can I propose, can I ask, first of all, if any members of the committee disagree with the staff recommendation that we should recommend the board makes an amendment to IAS 29 to accommodate Jim? Because nobody disagrees. Let's focus on Appendix B. We've had a number of suggestions that have come up here. I think the substantive changes that we've discussed today, David, would be that we highlight that IFRS 3 is the standard that should be referred to provide the guidance, the measurement, the recognition requirements to start the entity off at the period when it comes out of GYM, that we also modify that to say that in the case, this is an additional exception, I think we're right in now from what I'm hearing, that in the case of intangible assets, that the entity would only recognize those intangibles that would have been recognized under IAS 38 in its previous guise, in the sense that they were acquired intangibles or that they had otherwise met the criteria for recognition as internally generated intangibles. If there are any of those would be at fair value as the starting point.
And goodwill.
Sorry, yes, I don't know why I keep forgetting about goodwill. It's probably because I don't think it's an asset. I can say that now, Pat. All right. You obviously will have an opportunity to look at this again before it goes through to the board. For editorial comments, take those, anybody who's got those, and the other input that you've received, David. So does anybody object to the modified language of Appendix B? Okay. And then the agenda decision, or a lengthy agenda decision.
Should we come back to the general decision after the parents' commission?
Oh, sorry, yes. Yeah. The two bits in there. Thank you for that. All right. Shall we keep going, Joanna? Do you want to highlight your concerns with paper 12C? Oh, sorry.
I guess I have a concern as to the way that you've written this, Toshi, is this is what the staff think they should do, almost as though this is an interpretation as a result of what we've now decided to do with 29. And I'm not convinced that, A, yes, okay, people have got to use judgment, but and I guess, first of all, the question is, have we been asked, is part of the question, and certainly the tentative agenda decision implies the only question that we have been asked is one about how to deal with it in the gym situation, country, not in the consolidated county. If that's the case, then we've answered the question. If we also got a question to say, how do we deal with it in the country that is going to consolidate the gym, i.e. in this situation, South Africa, which my understanding is that is a question, do we actually need to specifically answer that question? And looking at your paper 12C, there are a couple of situations that I'd like to raise. I guess the first one is your first situation, whether that actually is feasibly possible, because if you are saying they presented IFRS compliance statements, the interest was consolidated and the interest was material, I'm not sure that that is actually a viable situation, because if the interest was material and that interest did not comply with IFRS, how could the consolidated ones comply with IFRS? But that aside, so ignoring that one. But the second one, for example, you have said that if they are, they've said they're not IFRS compliant, the interest consolidated, interest material, and then your conclusion is the staff do not think that the parent entity should apply IFRS 1 in this situation. Half an hour ago, we made a decision that if an entity has been non-IFRS compliant and it is coming back to being IFRS compliant, absolutely no question it has to comply with IFRS 1. So your conclusion there cannot be with the decision that we've just come to. And I haven't thought it all through, but I just feel uncomfortable if that is part of the question as to whether or not it has been thought through properly. And I have to admit, and this comes back to, I was thinking, because I was expecting Bob, you to say to me, well, how do we sort it out, Joanna? And I was thinking, well, how would I think about it? And I thought about it, and in fact, in some ways, actually saying it is a new entity as opposed to a new basis might actually be one way of saying what a consequential change is, because we could, if that was the case, make a consequential change to probably IS-27 to say something to the effect that if you have a subsidiary that is applying these particular paragraphs of IS-29, it is a new entity and you have to effectively dispose of the old one and acquire a new one, and then they can work out what the hell they have to do. Now, as I say, that was thinking, me just thinking, what is a possible solution? But I actually do believe that in order for, my gut feel is that in order for the parent to be able to use this, we need to make a consequential change to something. I'm not quite sure what the something is or what the consequential change is, but I'm not convinced it works. And I'm certainly very interested as to whether the South Africans in this case actually do think it works, because I'm not convinced by paper 12C, I guess is what I'm saying.
Maybe a couple of points, and there might be a couple to think through a little bit more and see if the other committee members have some thoughts. First of all, I think on a scope exception needed another standard, we do agree. I think our Appendix C does propose a consequential to IFRS 1. Now, I'm interested, actually, and intrigued to think through further whether a consequential to IS-27 would work. Because certainly, if we could do that, it would be certainly more consistent with some of the decisions we've made on IFRS 1, and I know That was a concern that was discussed in May, so that would be one I need to think about, and certainly if other people have some thoughts on that one, I think that would be useful in the discussion. I think secondly, in terms of addressing this issue of the parents, the feedback we received is, you know, the thoughts we went through in this paper are useful for thinking through the application. Certainly the question is, well, this is just staff thoughts, you know, does it go into further application guidance? I think what we'll see from the amendment we did is just add in, really, I think we have a paragraph in the amendment itself, 38O, just saying, well, for consolidated financial statements, you know, you follow this logic, accounting for your interest, and as you say, probably left it at that. Feedback we had as well, yeah, that does leave some judgment, but then, you know, whether all these fact patterns are always going to fit the judgments for every entity, and whether there really is another way of articulating what the consolidated parent should do here without getting into a number of different situations, I think staff found a challenge. So in short, I agree, I think there is a scope exception needed. We've got IFRS 1 here, I'd like to think through 27. Secondly, on the parent, you know, I think we should certainly acknowledge it here. Our preference is to really deal with it by one or two sentences versus a lot of application guidance.
Thanks, sir. Scott?
I think I agree with where Joanna came out. I wouldn't have started with, I had lots of concerns about 12C, but I think I would have gotten to the same place. I think conceptually the guidance we ought to give to the parents is that you have exchanged your investment in the old entity for an investment in the new entity. And so if you had previously been consolidating, the effect of that is you deconsolidate one entity and you consolidate new. If you had been previously been had it on a cost method because you concluded you didn't control anymore due to currency problems, then you would derecognize your cost method investment and recognize the assets and liabilities of the new accounting entity. And then in recognizing the assets and liabilities of the new accounting entity, apply whatever we decide for the entity itself that comes out of Jim. So if we say no goodwill, then the parent wouldn't recognize goodwill. And the only thing that leaves open is the gain or loss, because there will be one. I'm going to guess that if you showed somebody a situation and the result was a loss, we'd all feel like you ought to recognize that loss through P&L. And if you showed somebody that situation and it turned out there was a gain, we'd all feel like the gain ought to go to equity. I'm not sure what the answer is for the parent in situation, but I guess I'll be true to my thought process of recording it as an exchange transaction and saying if there's a gain or loss, there's a gain or loss.
That would be consistent with IAS 27, the way it's written at the moment.
I think so.
Have control of a subsidiary and you lose control but you don't lose your entire investment, then what you've got left is at fair value.
Right.
And work out the equation and work out the gain or loss. The alternative, of course, would be to say that what you're acquiring is something at its fair value and you're paying no consideration for it, in which case it's a bargain purchase, and I think we're pretty clear on what we do with bargain purchases as well. So, for a different, perhaps, rationale, I would come to the same position that you have come to. John, presumably, it would be agreeable.
But I think that can be done. The staff was looking for something that could be done in one or two sentences. I think that can be done in one or two sentences, that guidance. And then we don't have to go through all these different situations. They can work that out for themselves.
Okay. Laurence?
Yeah, I was concerned by the situation 3 in the paper and the staff review in support of U2 and the reasons for support of U2, because we are in a case where it is said in paragraph 22 that the parent entity determines it no longer controls the entity, so don't control. And then subsequently, the proposal is to say, but you account for it as if it were analogous to a combination of entities or businesses under common control.
So for me, it's inconsistent. Either you've lost control and you apply IFRS 1, or you have not lost control, and in which case, perhaps, effectively, you can refer to that approach. But one of them is inconsistent.
Okay. And Andrew?
So I just wanted to make sure... I just wanted to make sure I understood where we seem to be heading here. So are we saying that when the... In order to allow the parent to maintain IFRS-compliant consolidated financials, when the subsidiary goes into chronic hyperinflation, we will deconsolidate it, and then we will reconsolidate it when it comes out. Is that what we're saying?
I don't think you'd necessarily deconsolidate. I mean, I think that's an assessment you do under the literature to determine whether you're deconsolidating something, whether you've got a change in your interest. But I think what we're saying is, whatever that interest is at the point you emerge, it's a new interest. Now, that might be a new interest that you're consolidating. Maybe it's still an equity interest at that point in time, but it has a new basis, I think was what I was taking away there.
There's a period, well, if you take situation one, there's a period in which you've got a material subsidiary from which you can't get reliable numbers. So what's that? Sorry, I just want to make sure I understood what our proposed solution to that is in the group financials.
At the moment, we're silent on that.
Yeah.
I think we were only talking about what happens when you come out.
When you come out.
I thought we decided last meeting we couldn't really get anything about can't get numbers, can't solve that problem.
John?
Just in response to that, I saw it as, if you like, to me there are two issues. One is, what are we going to actually say how the parent should account for this new entity in IAS 29? And to me, that I think what I think I'm proposing here is get the one or two sentences say you're effectively got to if you've had something in there before, you've got to deconsolidate it, and you're getting something new. And that addresses to me all of the types of scenarios that are in here. It doesn't matter what the hell they actually decided to do in the period of chronic inflation. At least everyone coming out of it will do the same thing. Then to me there is a second question, which is, what did they say they complied with IFRS? Did they say they didn't comply with IFRS? All the rest of it. And if they said they didn't comply with IFRS last year, well, tough luck. We just decided an hour ago now that you've got to apply IFRS 1 again. So that situation is situation-specific, if you like, as to what they did decide to do, would be my, unless we want to give them an exemption from that as well. But we'd have to do that too, I think. But to me, there are two different things I was looking at, Andrew.
So we'd have to apply IFRS 1 when it became compliant again.
Unless we grant an exemption.
Yeah.
All right, let's not be too aggressive in trying to write exemptions everywhere. I would suggest that the staff write this up. Wherever the consequential amendment goes, whether it's in 27 or 29 or it's in both places, because I don't want to cover all of the permutations that might have existed which relate to specific judgments that have been made by a reporting entity, which could have changed its composition for other reasons as well. So things that were immaterial before might now become material. Leave that to the reporting entity to decide how it reported and whether IFRS 1 is something that it could apply a second time. In certain circumstances, I think there are reporting entities, groups, that have found ways of accounting for their gym subsidiaries, even though they're suffering from chronic hyperinflation and have achieved IFRS-compliant financial statements. So I think all we need to say is that in the circumstances in which an entity that previously was considered hyperinflationary effectively comes out of hyperinflation, that we use the IAS 27 type accounting, which in effect recognizes or derecognizes the old thing if it hadn't previously been de-recognized, recognizes the new thing, and specify on what basis, and that's presumably we've got to say there that it's the fair value of the recognized net assets as opposed to the fair value of the entity itself. You don't want to create another one, because I think I heard you all say that you don't want to recognize goodwill, which I'm happy about, and then leave it to the entities themselves to determine at what point they de-recognize or have already de-recognized, have stopped consolidating, and just give this reference back. So again, we're clear that it's business combination type accounting with the exceptions that we've written into it.
And the only remaining question is then the difference between de-recognizing the old investment and recognizing the new one. Does that go to profit or loss, or does that go to equity?
I think we propose in the standard it goes to profit and loss, because that's what I think you would get under either IFRS 3 or IAS 27. Do you want to see the words, or do you want to...
So I was just going to say, just in answer, thinking about Michael's thing, I need to think it through, but I think we've got to be consistent. Like, we've got a bargain purchase on one hand, or if you like, we've got two things. We've got a gain or loss when we get rid of it, and then we've got something, presumably, when we acquire it, because it won't balance out. Now, at the moment, you are suggesting that we've got this hyperinflation reserve. That would be inconsistent to me to take the gain or loss when you sell it to P&L and take the gain or loss when you acquire it to reserve. So we probably just need to make sure that we're consistent with them and got a logical approach to those two. I don't know the answer, but...
You're right, because if we were to take the approach that it goes, the difference goes to profit or loss when we recognise the new entity or the new basis, then it doesn't matter whether the old investment was de-recognized at that time or at an earlier date, because presumably if it was at an earlier date, we would have recognized a loss through profit or loss at that stage.
They definitely need to be consistent, and I would suggest it's probably P&L.
Okay. Are you clear on that, David? Do you need to ask any questions of us to clarify?
No, I mean, well, I say we'll include, I think, this in the see the revised draft thing to send around some comments. So, appreciate the feedback on that.
Yeah, okay. It's been very helpful to have the comments about the consequential amendments and how that might clear up. Consequential amendments should just be a consequence of the decisions we've already taken. But I'm hoping that nobody is now feeling uncomfortable as we've discussed this. So the intention is not to write detailed guidance for what a parent does, but simply to clarify or state clearly that it uses the technique of derecognition and recognition of the new piece, which is analogous to the current IAS 27 requirement. And to the extent that there are gains and losses, that they are recognized in P&L. Okay.
That leaves with the agenda decision.
Right.
Which I think what we need to do with the agenda decision is to reflect the whole of this discussion. So we would need to incorporate something about the parent company accounting in the case of a consolidated subsidiary that suffered chronic hyperinflation. I think if we work up some words and circulate that for your confirmation as part of our drafting of the IFRIC update.
And if we can possibly get it out by tonight for Joanna so that she doesn't interrupt her holiday too much. All right, let's take a 10-minute break. I think everybody's earned that, especially Toshi. Thank you very much for the hard work you've been doing on here and the outreach as well. Thank you, David. If we can start again at 10 minutes' time, just after 11:45, and we'll see what other items on the agenda we can finish off before 1 o'clock.